The theme for the afternoon talk is what matters. One of the things that I've noticed in the years of teaching is that as the time has gone by, there has been, in the last 20 to 30 years, a certain kind of shift which is going on. And of course, I'm just speaking generally here. And it's reflected here and elsewhere. And roughly, there's about 100 of us here in the hall, and roughly, it's about 60% women, and about 40% men. And in the privileged position of opportunities to speak with women and men, one of the factors that comes across with regard to that is the deep kind of questioning that's going on. And I think for years, and maybe for generations, we have been rather told what to believe. And people, society, us, have often lived, as it were, under two major shadows. And I call them shadows. One, on one side, tells us that the good life consists of getting rich, obviously, the maximization of pleasure. What are the other favorites? A long life, going death while one is asleep. Oh yes, and being popular and liked. These four or five, whatever, have incredible influence to be successful, rich, to have and to own, have much more pleasure in life than pain and difficulties and problems, have a long and healthy life, I said lie, yeah, I meant it, life, and die in one sleep. And if there is an afterlife, then of course one would go to heaven, which would be a kind of continuity of what went on there. And this view, which is a common view, is in a way imposed from above. We might call it consumer culture. We might call it secular society. It's a top-down view from our politicians, from our economists, from the corporate world, from the educators, and tragically from the parents. And sometimes you and I have also been faced with another strong view, and the view is with religion. And sometimes religion has been, and is, very top-down, run by men, authoritarian, telling us what we should believe and must believe, and a kind of climate impacting upon us of reward and punishment. If you believe this and do this, you'll be okay, and if you don't, God help you. More or less. This is all a dreadful oversimplification. I know. The outcome of this, the imposition from the top down view, brings amongst some of us, and I include myself, some questioning do I want to live under that shadow? Do I feel comfortable, I'm not a Buddhist, but do I feel comfortable as a Buddhist sitting under the Bodhi tree, which is enlightenment for all beings, and only seeing 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 Tibetan male monks and not a Tibetan woman in sight? Can I feel comfortable with that? So, if I have some questioning power left inside of me, if I haven't lost it all, then the outcome of that will bring about, is there some kind of alternative? And therefore, I feel it's not surprisingly reflected in the kind of questioning which women and men are doing, which says, is there something deeply spiritual about life, about the experience of life, which I can have access to, which, as it were, comes from grassroots? It's not coming from above and being told what to believe, secular or religious, but coming from deep within. And once one starts to make that shift inside, then that kind of exploration means that we don't have any clear, absolute answers. We don't. We're just human. We're in a state of just being human, and we're in a state of finding out what matters, what's worthwhile, what can I draw upon, where can I go? And one thing that one doesn't have, if you're a woman who is questioning and a man who is questioning, you don't have security. You don't have it. It's taken away from you. Society wants to give you security. Please take out the pension plan and all that nonsense. And religion says, oh, join us, be with us, we'll give you security of eternal life or something. But if one says, hey, wait a minute, that's from above. I want to explore from grassroots. I want to find out what it is to be alive on this earth, to feel, to think, to discover, and to find out for myself. That's a shift. It's an incredibly important shift. I gave a retreat in Bodh Gaya. I'm a bit of a fan of Bodh Gaya. This is the place of the Buddha's enlightenment. And we had a retreat there with normal kind of numbers, around 130 on the retreat. Somewhere between 90 and 100 were women on the retreat. Why? What's the questioning? So I think we can learn collectively and together with each other. So where are we going to start? What's going to help us find out what matters, what really matters? And somehow we have to start off actually where we are. So it's not surprising, I feel, that initially, in any kind of exploration, we have to have some kind of sense of what it is to be. What is it to be? Just to be. Just to breathe, as Stephen was given the instructions this morning. Just to sit. Just to walk on this earth. If I've got no answer, and I've got no beliefs that I can rely upon, I'll need some extension of some kind of trust somewhere, and maybe, some kind of significance is found by the present moment. That perhaps if I can just rely a little bit on the present moment, that maybe something out of that begins to touch me in some way or other. And therefore I'm willing to put aside, as much as possible, lots of my memories and lots of my future planning and mental escapes in order to see what this is about, just to be. When I was in the monastery, years and years and years ago, One of the interesting things which struck me then and continues to do so, and you might find this in the time here, that in ordinary life we think, I know somebody because I know his or her personal story. I know, say, about her upbringing, her or his affluence, or what he did, or what she didn't do, or where he was, or etc. I know all about the personal, their likes, their dislikes, their approvals and their disapprovals, etc. And I often think, I know somebody through knowing the story of the person's life. And you think that sometimes it is the only way to get to know somebody. In the monk's life, and I find this still goes on, most of us had absolutely no interest in the personal story of each other. The only reason that the other monks and nuns knew that I was from the West was obvious. It was a clue. And they probably knew I was English because I was also far too lazy to spend the time learning Thai language. It's a idiosyncratic nationalistic trait of Britain. We can't be bothered to learn other languages if we want to make everybody learn ours instead. So sometimes, this is important here, the sense of knowing is not about the personal story. We can get a sense of knowing another without knowing anything about them. Could it be the same for ourselves? We can sit in our meditation and we can go on morning, noon and night about our little personal soap operas, our little dramas, all the things in life that we like and dislike. And we think, well, this is all part of me, all part of my personality. And we can spend every sitting and walking having some internal dialogue with somebody else, somewhere else, and we're sitting in the meditation, and we're thinking, well, when I see this person, I'll say this, because I've really been wanting to say this for a long time. And then the other person will say that. And then when they say that, now I'm going to say this. The trouble is, with these lovely internal dialogues in meditation, I don't know if you've noticed, the other person never keeps to the script. One's so arrogant inside of oneself that one actually believes, one knows what the other person thinks and the other person is going to say when we meet them. People are completely unpredictable. This is called life. So is it possible that all the focus of our attention and my personality and what I was and what I did and what I might do may not actually be helping us to know who we are? Sometimes things like this do not sit well with some of my psychotherapist friends, but hang in. Sometimes we are so interested in the personal story and we believe and we imagine what matters and who I am is all around my personal story and my personal issues. No, it isn't. And there's a little instinctive clue that goes on inside of us when we're in the meditation room, when you're walking on the grass, when you're standing, you get sick and tired of thinking about this, that and the other. Thinking about what I was, what I did in the past, how I was in the past, was it good, was it bad, was it the right thing to do, not wrong thing. Get sick and to death of thinking about the future and what will I be in the future and where will I be and how will I be. Sick to death of thinking, do others like me, they don't like me, do I like these other people here, or I don't like them, etc. All of that that goes on inside, plenty of moments arise and we say to ourselves, I just want this to stop. I'm fed up with all these moods, all these states of mind and all this thinking. Why? Because there's a little sense inside that maybe out of the little drama there is something far more significant. And there is. Period. There is. If we are to nourish and encourage the questioning inside of ourselves, it's going to take a rather important change inside. Whether we're, some of you in here are 17, 18, 19 years of age, and some of you are more down at the other end of the life spectrum, in the 60s and 70s, and maybe even more, etc. And those of us who are more at one end of the scale, at the other, quite often notice and will say to ourselves and each other that even as we get older, inwardly we don't feel that different from when we were much younger. We might look, as my good mother, who's 84 years of age, she says to me, inside of myself, I don't really feel any different from when I was young. And so when I look in the mirror now, I can't believe what the mirror is showing. Because inside I feel the same, and outside I look different. You know, of course, Buddhists would be very happy to say, as I said to my mother, look, what you see in the mirror, mother, is not you. You just think it's you, but it's a bit too hard for her, so okay. Sometimes, in the inner life, there is still lots of vitality and love and connection and joy. Outwardly, it appears different. If it's like that, how easily things don't clip together. Just a minute. Don't go away. How easily that which we carried when we were young, we can still be carrying with us when we're older. If I feel when I am a young person I don't have enough and I haven't resolved this, I haven't given up this, I don't have enough, I will carry this view in my 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s and 70s, and I'll still carry it, and then there is death just around the corner, and death says, not only is it that you're not going to get what you want, but death is coming along and saying to us, I'm also, death is talking here, I'm also going to take away what you have. And you can't take one bit of it with you. And death makes a joke of all the pursuance of owning and having. If you who are young haven't resolved it in the present, do not think for one moment that you will feel you have enough at some point in your life. It will just manifest itself in a new form, despite life gives us so much, but we can't see it, we can't feel it, we can't experience it, because we got this idea inside of ourselves, I haven't got enough. A few days ago, I mentioned yesterday evening, I was speaking in Jaffa. Really, I like really. It's a bit of a Wild West place, but I really like Jaffa. Great hummus, falafels, etc. And we had a Dharma evening there together, and I received very kindly two invitations from two people to come next April when I come back to Israel to apparently a wealthy suburb, I think in Tel Aviv or nearby, called Caesarea, is it? Something like that? You heard of it. Okay, Caesarea. Some of you might even live there, so I'm going to be very careful what I say. And I said, so I wrote a note to the person that, if possible, yes sir, yeah. Be happy to come. So one Dharma friend said to me, Christopher, why are you going there to give some Dharma teaching? Why go to Caesarea? Well, why not? And he said, something like, if I get it right, it's the rich, they are living in Caesarea, and that, frankly, he said, they're just too lazy to go to Jaffa. So just tell them to come to Jaffa rather than you go to Caesarea. Like that. So, I said, I don't quite think quite like this. And I said, behind the closed doors of Caesarea, forgive my pronunciation, but you know the place anyway. Behind the closed doors of Caesarea, there is as much suffering going on as behind the closed doors of people who live in Jaffa. The rich are no more protected from it than the poor. And my daughter's mother, Gwenwyn, who lives 10 minutes walk away, is in a voluntary network organization which is on behalf of women who are subjected to domestic abuse. And she said to me just a week or two ago, "Say, Christopher, you know," she said, "we sometimes have the stereotyped picture of domestic violence is something, and the aggravation of it, mostly upon women, but sometimes on children as well, is coming from poor, alcoholic, or addictive, violent, drunkard, unemployed groups of people. The place where the women go to is called a refuge." And she said, "Who are the kind of people they're running from? Doctors, priests, business people, probation officers, psychiatrists, lawyers, architects. In other words, the whole spectrum. And sometimes we get this image in the world of I don't have enough, and if I had a lot more, I would be better off. And when such people, in this case such women, have the courage, and it takes courage, to say, I don't want to live in this situation anymore. I don't want to be an appendix to wealth or whatever. And actually move out of the violent environment there. Sometimes that inflames even more fury. Because now it's gone behind the closed doors and the electric fences and the guard dogs and all that. It's gone out. Others know. The Center for Refuge knows. And I think Dharma teachings and practices can't be concerned with rich and poor in the way that my friend was concerned about, but much more concerned what helps to transform a situation. What helps to work with it, to see through it? Where is the suffering in it? And you and I can be completely deceived by appearances, by prosperity. And if we make it clear in ourselves, the pursuit of having is not the priority. If we really make it clear in ourselves, one of the things I noticed in my life, and hopefully you do too, it opens up a perception and a possibility for another way of being in the world. And if one forgets, say, aha, King Yama, this is what the Buddhists say, King Yama is wandering around. King Yama is the Lord of Death. King Yama is just to remind me that whatever I have, I will lose. Death will take it away. So since life is just a transitional and breathtakingly extraordinary event, I shouldn't worry, because if I have less through life, then I have less to lose. So actually I'm better off. I know it's a strange logic for many of you, but live with it. If I have less, I'm content with what is. I'll move through life much more lightly. And think of it, if you have less in your home, there's less to break down, less to go wrong, less to clean, less to change. You know, think of all the pluses, the benefits of having less. And that conserves the energy for something other. Something other. That human beingness. I mentioned earlier a little bit of the value, a little bit of it. Could speak a lot, of course, about the present moment. And there's one person who wrote me a short note, that, and it's a common voice. Sometimes, even if we've been quite new to meditation or have been sitting for some time, there is a kind of looking forward to this. One's got nowhere to go, absolutely nothing to do. It's nightmarishly hot outside. It's relatively cool in here. There are no arguments going on, etc. No one's going to be walking all over us. We don't need a visa to cross over from one part of the room to the other. And the mind is not content with that. It just says, when is it going to be over? How long to go? Perhaps the teacher's gone into some deep trance, or has gone into the timeless realms and is completely out of touch with our knees, or whatever. And even though all we have with the life is the present, it's the one thing that does carry for us some authenticity, is the present moment. Sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, being on the earth, just one moment. And yet, We want to be away from it. Yet, we want the potency of the present moment. We want what it is in this moment to finish. And so not surprisingly, there is the kind of persecution of the thought, when will it be over? And sometimes, when we're in a state of dissatisfaction, and some of you will notice this today, and one shouldn't forget this point, but you will, but never mind. When something particular is a little difficult, like sitting in meditation, and we can't handle the little difficulty, we go from the particular to the general. We're feeling unhappy or a state of unrest about something. We're not handling it very well, so it spills and gets bigger. And when it gets bigger, we will start finding fault with everything and everybody. So we've got a little pain in the knee, that's the particular. We're doing our mantras for the end of the sitting, or whatever. We're still feeling, oh, this is so hard, it's so difficult. And then in comes the pain, the restlessness, the agitation and the doubt. Just follow the mindset. Some pain or dissatisfaction, bringing about some restlessness or agitation in mind and body, and then comes the doubt. And when the doubt has grown big enough, we'll look out around us with doubt. We'll see fault, we'll see blame, we'll see what we don't like, we'll just keep seeing through our blessed knees. Our knee will be in our face. Do you know what I mean? This isn't right. All right, the knee hurts. Oh, it's not a crisis. However, it's become one, the effect of which we see the fault everywhere. We go from the particular to the general. And every phobic reactivity in life is about that movement. Whether it's called nationalism, whether it's called homophobia, or all the other phobias that go on, we've grabbed hold of a particular, and then we've made the generality out of it. And it's extraordinary diligence and a commitment to truth to stay with what is the particular. And when we're saying, we can look around, one of the common ones is, just a bunch of zombies here, isn't it? No. Or, God, they're so deadly serious, etc. One's having a difficult time, and then one projects everywhere. I had a nice turn of phrase this morning. One, sometimes in the retreat situation, and used in context of other matters, one could say, gosh, being here is truly being in the living theatre of the absurd. Why not? Why not? There's so much which is absurd in life anyway, so why not spend 7 days in the complete theatre of it? Why not? But maybe, if we're looking and inquiring a bit more, having will be less of a priority in life, and something else will begin to come into us, hidden by this constant pursuit of having. And that brings some joy out of life and some wonder. And I say that applies to the poor and to the privileged amongst us. Stephen mentioned in the dining room, rather, a number of you stood for the much or all, either here, somewhere outside as well, for this standing meditation which we have from 11:45 to 12:30, and another one which takes place after the talks. And quite often in the tradition of meditation for insight, often the emphasis is placed on the walking and the sitting, or in some traditions just the walking, or a balance between the two. And all I can do is just heartily recommend the use of the standing meditation. And there's something rather nice about standing around all day and doing nothing. And just sometimes just to stand on this earth for no reason than to be alive. No other reason. To feel one's life as a human being. And perhaps engage in a little reflection in the standing, that just to stand is enough. And let the brain cells and the being inside of ourselves just stand and just be still and just to rest in the standing. Just to rest in it. And it's one of those kind of meditations and practices, when cultivated and when developed, contribute enormously, not only with a harmonious flow of the energy and the sense of well-being, but in the heart give a sense of fulfillment and connectedness just through standing. And I remember in the monastery, if I may say, we did standing meditation every day. Teacher insisted that it was for everyone outside and under the trees or in the sala, it means the Dharma hall, there, because he didn't trust us if we were claimed we were doing standing in our hut, because we could be doing lying down meditation instead, you know, lying down meditation. So it had to be visible. And just the regularity and the quiet dedication, the discipline of just standing, even though it looks a little absurd, because we're not standing waiting for the train to come in, or standing in the queue, or whatever, we're just standing. But the presence of that standing contributes to the harmony and the well-being of heart, mind, body with the environment, just by standing. And it may be a little uncomfortable initially, and someone might have to bend the back a little bit, or bend the knees a little bit, or make some shift in that way. But with a little practice, one can stand. And if I may say, not to show off in any way, but each day under the tree with a lovely old monk, Por Longbut, who is 70 years plus, we did our 3-hour standing every day under the tree. He on one side, me on the other. 12 till 3 every day we did. Just to stand. And in all of that, lots of the storylines that go on and lots of the thinking that goes on, all of that begins to drop away, and there is a sense of something other that comes through. Sense of something else about this mystery and this extraordinariness of living there, which we can't find in the religious books. We can't find in all these scientific books or whatever. That's in the field of language out there in the world of words. But something that is the human being can come through. And therefore it's never second hand. And that's why we say, please sit mindfully, walk mindfully, stand mindfully, be present to life. There is no greater act of love in this world than to give immediate attention to the immediacy of life. It is the great act of love. And so every time you and I, we bring our attention back to the moment. Every time you and I take a step with some mindfulness, Every time you and I are willing to drop all our future thinking and all our indulging in our memories, etc., that bringing of attention to the immediacy of life is love itself at work. Just like if you're with your children, or if you're with your grandchildren, and giving the child total attention, you're really giving the child total attention, that is love. It's love. Attention is love. And we're here to feel the love that's with life and to give life the total attention it deserves. And if we do that, it will give us so much we can't believe. It will give us so much we can't believe. May all beings live with attention. May all beings live with love. May all beings be touched by what matters. Okay. Let's have a quiet minute together.